Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the most memorable guests I've had on the show is novelist Mateo Ascaripur. His energy is almost contagious. He was on a few years ago to talk about his startup satire, Black Buck. That novel became an instant New York Times bestseller. Maybe after our interview? Maybe not. So how did Mateo follow up on the success of his debut novel? Did he write a sequel called Black Buck Part 2?
Yes.
Of course not. He wrote a 400-page doorstop of a novel called This Great Hemisphere. It's set 500 years in the future. It's a sci-fi epic that, you know what? I'm going to let Mateo break it down for you. He returns now to Beta to discuss his sophomore novel and why he took great pains to distance it from his stellar debut.
I remember 2020. I was on my friend Irvin Weatherby's rooftop, and I was saying, hey, man, you know, we're really going to go hard on the sales angle in terms of Black Buck. The book is coming out in a few months. I'm not going to shy away from the fact that I was a salesman. I mean, I set the book in the very building that I worked in. However, in doing that and in playing that up and in generating the excitement and the hype around it, I know that it could be difficult to extricate myself from that when it comes to writing another book. But I plan to go in a completely different direction to show people that I'm not a salesman who had happened to write a book, but I'm a writer who had just happened to write about sales. So I'd already had the idea for what would become This Great Hemisphere in 2020, even though it wasn't fully fleshed out. And it was orders of magnitude more difficult to pull off. But I got what I wanted out of it, and I do believe that I expanded myself as a writer, and then I'm better for having written it.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're better for having read it. Can you tell us a bit about This Great Hemisphere? And you touched on it, but I want to get a little more information about why you decided to write it.
Yes. So This Great Hemisphere is set 500 years in the future in a world where there are invisible people who are literally see-through, and then members of the dominant population who have visible skin. It focuses on a young woman, Sweetmint. Now, when the book opens up, Sweetmint's brother, who she had lived with, who she loved, who was really the only person that she could call family in her life, or blood in her life, has disappeared. He's been gone for 3 years. She's moving through that grief as much as she can, and she gains an apprenticeship with the premier inventor of the land, one of two men who had rebuilt the Northwestern Hemisphere from the ashes. Now she's working with this man, and then one day she finds out that the head of their hemisphere has been murdered, and the primary suspect is her big brother, again, who she had presumed dead and was definitely missing. Now there is a political upstart, a member of the dominant population running on an anti-invisible platform who says, I am going to become elected within 5 days and we need to find this guy. Then there's the top law enforcement officer in the land, also a member of the dominant population, who says, no invisible is going to upstage me. I'm going to find this guy in 5 days. And then there's young Sweetmint, whom the hemisphere thinks nothing of, when the hemisphere believes she is powerless, who says, no, I'm going to find my brother in 5 days. So it is a novel about many things: siblinghood, love, family, duty, ambition, power, as well as what does it mean to see and be seen.
Yeah, very well said. So how did you come up with this idea of the invisibles?
The idea came to me from an experience that I had in 2019. I was on the New York City subway sitting down, and an older man and a woman walk on, and the man turns to the woman asking her where she'd like to sit. And as he awaits her answer, he just points at me while sitting directly at me. And it was such a strange and surreal experience, because it was as if in pointing at me, he wasn't even perceiving me. He was more so perceiving an absence, whereas I was present. And they walked toward me, and I was just, Doug, I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought one of them was going to sit on my lap. I didn't know what was going to happen. And then they just wedged themselves into the half a seat beside me and you know, sort of pushed me a little bit. And at night, I lay in bed, more so out of curiosity, wondering what happened. It wasn't any self-pity. It wasn't any feeling bad for myself, but more so just trying to understand, did this man not really see me? And if he didn't see me, then what did he see? And those questions then gave way to other questions because, you know, as you know, we writers, we do our best to take control of a narrative rather than having a narrative take control of us. And the questions began to form of, you know, what if there were a race of invisible people? They're invisible, right? But what would they look like if they could be seen or perceived? How do they become invisible? Would they be revered by folks who aren't visible, or would they be subjugated and oppressed? How do they live? Where do they live? How do they love? Where do they love? What amount of levity is present in their lives? What amount of tragedy or darkness is present in their lives, and how do they persevere through it? And soon, Doug, these questions gave way to answers, and these answers formed into what would become This Great Hemisphere.
Mm, yeah. And your two epigraphs also refer to invisibility. Could you share them with us?
Let's do it. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me. Ralph Ellison. And the second epigraph. Invisible to whom? Toni Morrison.
Hmm. Thank you for reading those. Yeah. You wrote this novel from a fascinating point of view. It's close third person POV. Can you tell us a bit about that, what that is and why you took this approach? Because I'd never encountered it before.
So when I first drafted the novel, I was trying to write a short novel and I failed. And someone who had read an early version said, this is an outline. Go rewrite this entire thing and go build a world, you know, which was great advice. They also said, you know, two thirds of this is written in close third person. Do you want to write in close third person? If so, you know, go streamline the entire novel. And I said, I don't know what close third person is. maybe it's due to a lack of having an MFA. I don't know, but I had to Google close third person. But close third person is essentially third person, but limited from the perspective of one person, right? So with Sweetmint, when I'm writing about Sweetmint, I am limiting the perceptions that I write about to her own. I'm not going to have her in a scene with her and a surrogate father of sorts named Rusty and share Rusty's internal thoughts as well or his perceptions of what's going on. It's just limited the scope of Sweetman in that way. And this book uses a multi-POV, so three main characters or three main perspectives. There's Sweetmint, there is Stefan Jolis, the political upstart that I spoke of, and then there's Leon Kurtz, the top law enforcement officer, or AKA Hemispheric Guard, the director of the Hemispheric Guards that I spoke of. So when I'm in those chapters from their perspectives, it's written in third person, but limited to their own points of view.
One of the biggest challenges you must have faced while writing This Great Hemisphere is all of the world building you had to do. What was that like?
Yeah. I'm chuckling from trauma. So the book continued to get more and more and more difficult until it didn't. And in writing the world, at first, I was overcompensating. I was writing every single little detail of every single place and every single person. And I was overcompensating because I was writing 500 years in the future. And I, at first, you know, foolishly thought that the more minute details I provided, the realer the world would be. But that's just not how we exist. And that's not how vibrant places come alive in a novel. They come alive through contrasts, right? If I am pointing out every single little detail, then almost no detail matters and no detail stands out. So my incredible and incredibly gifted editor, Pilar Garcia Brown, helped me see that and helped me pull out from draft to draft to further highlight the aspects of this world and the aspects of these people that I wanted the reader to see and I wanted the reader to feel. But before I even gave it to Pilar, I had written two or so drafts, perhaps three, And because I didn't outline the novel and the questions were just piling up, whenever I'd pull the thread of one question, 15 would fall out. And they were piling up and piling up and piling up. And they were hard to keep track of. So after the second or third draft, I stopped and I opened up a blank Word document and I put world building at the top. And I just allowed myself to ask every single question that came to mind. How long do these people live? How many people are in the Northwestern Hemisphere? How does the Northwestern Hemisphere compare to the Southeastern, the Southwestern, and the Northeastern? What is the Northwestern Hemisphere's form of government? How many people are in the government? How do the people of the dominant population dress? Okay, the invisible people, if they're walking around essentially naked, right? What are the ways that they see each other? How do the dominant population see them? How are these people free? How are they oppressed? What do things smell like? What do they eat? What does their food look like? Down to herbs, right? Just so that I had a fuller picture of what was going on, even if I didn't include all of that. And then after I'd finished that doc and had about 7,000 words of world building, I was better able to inhabit the world that I was building and hopefully make it more habitable for readers.
Mm-hmm. And I think you did that. Mission accomplished. The Rimoya is something that is referred to throughout. What is the Rimoya?
Rimoya, in simplest terms, is an invisible's aura that can be perceived by other invisibles. Invisibles cannot perceive the Rimoya of a member of the dominant population. I keep saying it in that way. We call them in the book DPs or Dippies, right? And they think that that's due to just a lack of spirit, a lack of vitality that these folks have. I almost gave a couple spoilers away, but a Rimoya is like an aura within the book, is defined as a cell spirit. And it is this vitality, this life force that is felt and is perceived through feeling and is also intrinsically tied to the ancestors of an invisible. And you can almost feel your ancestors in a way guiding you without hearing it. It's more so just a feeling. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say about Rimoyas, because there's the Rimoyas are incredibly important in this novel, and there's ways in which they shift and shape and make it hard to conceal who you are, but also make it extremely apparent how an invisible is perceived and seen. Yeah. They just, even thinking about them, bring a smile to my face.
This great hemisphere is set 500 years in the future, but there are some things that resonate with our current society. Did that surprise you?
No. I mean, you know, Doug, there are people who have read and finished this book this week, and they say, are you clairvoyant? What's going on? There are things in this book that are literally happening right now or have happened recently. And I'm not prescient. I'm not clairvoyant. I am a student of history. And so much of what is happening today has already happened in different and similar ways throughout recent history. And we can assume throughout the millennia and millennia and millennia of humanity's existence. So whatever is extremely relevant to today that is in the book, it's just an echo of history.
Very well said. Yeah, history repeats over and over. You're absolutely right about that. What do you want readers to take away from this great hemisphere?
This is always a tough question, and believe it or not, you're the first person who has asked me this. There's a lot that I would love the reader to think about. There are many questions that I would like them to ask themselves by the end of the novel and hopefully be able to formulate some of their own answers. But I believe that if I could distill it all down to one thing, I want the reader to question the cyclical nature of history, as we were just speaking about, Doug. That if within this novel there are echoes of the past, if within this novel there are reflections of the present, and if within this novel those reflections and echoes are set 500 years into the future, then how, if at all, can we disrupt the cyclical nature of history? And how, if at all, can we progress as a people and as a species? I'm presenting the question, and it's up to the reader to find an answer that resonates with them. But if they're looking for an answer, then my only answer is this. We act in ways large and small. Hmm. Instead of doing nothing, we do something. But that something does not have to be on a massive macro scale. I firmly believe that actions that could even be perceived as small will lead to great changes in perception. And if we can more better see ourselves and others as people, then I do firmly believe that this world will become a better place.
Hmm. Very well said. Extremely well said. Thank you for that. Matteo Escarapur, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on This Great Hemisphere. It is a very powerful novel. I am looking forward to reading your next book and talking to you about it and all the books after that.
Doug, always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Matteo Escarapur is the author of This Great Hemisphere. Find out more about Matteo and his expansive novel at wpr.org/beta.
When it came to his music and came to his band, he was totally, utterly colorblind. He used to say, "I don't care if you're black, white, blue, green. If you can play, I want you."
Coming up, biographer James Kaplan will tell us how Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans combined their talents to create the greatest jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.